This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. Earlier today, the U.S. Congress debated the future of the Occupy D.C. encampment in Washington's McPherson Square. We have details of that debate on today's 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. On Tuesday, the 24th of January, 2012, a congressional committee contemplated new measures to evict the Occupy DC movement from McPherson Square, where it has been based since October 6, 2011. At issue is a conservative effort to evict the occupation through new anti-camping legislation versus the National Park Service's more liberal and flexible enforcement policy aimed at defending First Amendment rights of assembly and expression. The hearing centered on a legal decision on whether to grant a permit for the D.C. occupation. The hearing was convened by the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, with testimony from Columbia District officials, a legal scholar, and the head of the Park Service. Participants of the Occupy D.C. movement were not allowed to testify. In today's 5 o'clock shadow, we present highlights of the current congressional clash over the fate of the Occupy movement.
Among the pillars that undergird this grand republic, at least two are at bar this morning. Number one, the freedom of speech and expression, and number two, our respect for the rule of law. These two principles are entirely consistent. Indeed, they have to be consistent. They can and they do coexist. So today we are not here to discuss the merits or demerits of the Occupy movement, at least I'm not. I'm here to try and glean what process, if any, the National Park Service goes through in determining whether to allow a residential encampment among the homes and offices in a busy area in downtown D.C., especially one where camping is strictly prohibited. And it is impossible to explore the role of the National Park Service without also hearing from the leaders within the District of Columbia. I suspect the witnesses from the District of Columbia will testify, as has been publicly reported, with respect to any adverse consequences associated with this encampment. We have all read with outrage and shock about an infant abandoned in a tent on one of the coldest days of the year. Mayor Gray wrote the Park Service on January 12th to warn them of dangerous rodent infestation, the risk of foodborne illnesses, and other potentially deleterious, if not deadly, concerns such as hypothermia and carbon monoxide poisoning. The District of Columbia and its leaders are in a completely untenable position. It is their responsibility to protect the health and safety of its residents, including those residents in McPherson Square. However, they do not have the authority to make the decision whether or not to allow the camp to exist. The federal government owns the land and governs its use, sharing responsibility for the health and safety of those in the park. The Department of Interior has taken responsibility for the decision to allow the indefinite overnight camping at McPherson Square, and the process by which they reached this decision is at best curious and legally fragile. So many of us look forward to today's hearing because we were under the apparent misapprehension that camping was illegal in McPherson Square. And we look forward to hearing the National Park Service explain the difference between camping and a 24-hour vigil, especially when that 24-hour vigil lasts several months. The evidence is clear, at least in my judgment, that sleeping, cooking, and camping are taking place in McPherson Square despite protestations to the contrary, and apparently despite the clear prohibition against camping. So, to sum it up, issues of public safety for the protesters and others is important. Issues of free speech are important. Issues of cost and who bears the cost are important. It is manifestly unfair that the District of Columbia assume all the cost and liabilities for decisions made by the National Park Service. But at the bottom of it all is the issue of fair and equal application of the law. Because from this vantage point, it appears that there are at least two very different sets of rules. And with the spring and summer a short distance away, I find it curious that tourists cannot come and pitch a tent in McPherson Square if they're camping for fun, but if they're camping in protest of fun, the National Park Service would welcome them. And with that, I would recognize the gentleman from Illinois, the ranking member, Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution reads, and I quote, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. End of quote. Of course, the right to protest is not unrestricted. The Supreme Court has determined that certain limitations can be imposed to strike a delicate balance between order and the right to be heard. In a public forum, the government may restrict expression with time, place, and manner regulations. However, restrictions cannot be based upon the content of the speech, and the regulation must not be substantially broader than necessary to achieve the government's interest. The history of dissent is a long and productive one. From the abolitionist flyers to the labor movement of the early 20th century, to women's suffrage, to the civil rights marches and peace protests, our country has become a more inclusive and enlightened nation because people spoke truth to power. Dissenters met government resistance but preserved. Around-the-clock vigils and sit-ins are nothing new. The students that maintained their seats at a North Carolina Woolworth lunch counter ignited a movement to challenge injustice and helped change America. I understand that to be a part of civil disobedience, but I encourage those who seek government redress to operate in a peaceful manner. That being said, I certainly appreciate the National Park Service and the U.S. Park Police measured approach to the D.C. occupiers. We have not seen the disarray here that has been broadcast across our television screens from other cities. The federal agencies overseeing the lands and parks have a specific role in ensuring that the First Amendment rights are respected and protected. The District of Columbia, as a protest site, is of particular significance and importance. The district has a history of hosting some of the most significant protest activities of the modern era. Accordingly, in 2011, there were over 600 First Amendment activities on our national park lands. So I find it curious that this particular demonstration has risen to the level of a congressional hearing. The Occupy DC movement has not encountered widespread arrests. The vigils are in a concentrated area. The district receives funds for reimbursement annually for such activities. Further, the discretion allowed the Park Service allows for a reasonable approach of compliance, then enforcement or expulsion. I believe going forward, the Occupy DC movement should continue to be closely monitored to ensure proper safety, health, and sanitation. Interaction and cooperation of the various agencies to monitor the site should be encouraged. However, this protest, in its current form, does not rise to the level of necessary congressional intervention. This subcommittee should defer to the discretion of the National Park Service and err on the side of the First Amendment. And I'd like to yield just a minute to myself to read a portion of the statement from the Occupy DC General Assembly submitted to staff. Like so many whose voices are not heard in the halls of Congress, we have been precluded from speaking today on a matter that directly concerns us. That we have to ask a member of Congress to speak for us here is symbolic of the disenfranchised and top-down nature of the government that we're fighting to democratize. Citizens of a free country should not have to ask for permission to occupy public spaces. Our occupation of McPherson Square is an expression of our First Amendment right to free speech and peaceful assembly. We are maintaining a site of protest, a physical presence that gives visibility and voice to our dissent. We are creating a space in which free speech flourishes, not only the free speech of occupiers, but that of the general public, the empowered, and the disenfranchised alike. End of quote. Like most people, the members of Occupy DC at McPherson Square do not relish being in uncomfortable conditions that humans without housing have endured for millennia. We do so because it has become a necessary tactic to express our concern for the country's direction in a way that will maintain public attention. 2 out of every 3 Americans, incidentally, agree that our country is headed in the wrong direction. A far smaller percentage approves of the job Congress is doing. And while foreclosure has become a hallmark of modern America, the solutions to our country's numerous problems do not include suppressing free speech and evicting patriots from their tents. The very existence of a committee of politicians controlling a city, none of them were elected in its offensive, though McPherson Square happens to have been declared federal land. D.C.'s forced submission to congressional control is the height of hypocrisy for a nation that considers itself the global arbiter of democracy. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the opportunity and yield back the balance of our time.
We will now welcome our distinguished panel of witnesses. Mr. Paul Quantra is the Deputy Mayor for Public Safety and Justice for the District of Columbia. Chief Kathy Lanier is the Chief of the Metropolitan Police Department. Dr. Muhammad Akhtar is the Director of the D.C. Department of Health. Mr. Timothy Zick is the Cable Research Professor of Law at William & Mary School of Law, and Mr. Jonathan Jarvis is the Director of National Park Service. Professor Zick.
Although we're focused here on a particular public place, I think this is an important national issue. There have been Occupy movements, as you know, across the country. This is a protest that is unique, a demonstration that's unique in its methods. It raises some of the same resource concerns that sit-ins and parades and marches do, but it's different in an important respect, and that is this. The movement seeks permanence of place. It seeks to occupy or commandeer a place as part of its First Amendment message. I think it's important to keep that in mind as you consider the First Amendment implications of possibly evicting them from this place. It's not simply, as Chairman Issa said, an opportunity to be heard. It's also an opportunity to be seen. Both of those things are protected under the First Amendment. The place that's being occupied and demonstrated in this particular instance is a special place. It's a public forum, which under First Amendment doctrine means that, as the Supreme Court has said, time out of mind, people have gathered there for assembly and speech and petition to discuss matters of public concern. And in particular in the District of Columbia, given the situs of government, these places have been treated by the D.C. Circuit and other courts as special forums or locuses for protest activity. That said, as some committee members have already suggested, protest rights in public places are not absolute. That is true. The agency that is charged with managing this property has two main responsibilities. The first, which I think it's discharged quite well, particularly in light of its history in the courts, and I can speak to that maybe in questions rather than my statement, is to make sure that First Amendment rights are fully preserved and robustly protected. It has done that in this particular case through a process of negotiated management rather than forceful eviction. To my mind, that's a plausible choice to make and a worthy one. I'm in the odd position here of actually defending an agency for potentially overprotecting speech. It's a rather odd position for me because normally I'm critical of the government for restricting First Amendment rights in public places. So in terms of that particular trusteeship obligation to protect the rights of people to assemble, petition, and speak in public places, the agency, as I said, has discharged its responsibilities and obligations quite well. I know the committee, though, is concerned about the balance of those particular fundamental liberties with the interests of the public in safety and health and order and those sorts of concerns. I can say, having looked at the regulations, that the agency is in compliance with most of them. I can't speak in particular to the camping one because that depends on facts on the ground and a totality of circumstances determination by the agency. But no permit is required for a demonstration of this size. There are no explicit time limits in the regulations on protests. Some structures are permitted. Some, as I understand it, have been removed on action of the agency and local officials. So in large part, the agency has been in compliance with its own regulations. I understand the concern that the agency not be permitted to prefer some speakers over the others, and I want to be clear about what that obligation is under the First Amendment. It is not inappropriate, necessarily, to prefer fundamental liberties to other uses of the property. What would be inappropriate is to prefer some speakers over others based upon their viewpoint or the content of their message. I'm not aware of any instance in which the agency has not permitted a group to occupy a place in this fashion, to demonstrate in this way, but permitted this particular demonstration to go forward. So it's not clear to me that the agency has done anything in violation of that principle of content neutrality. So in my view, it can prefer that use to other uses of the public property. There are concerns, I think, about allowing people to occupy and demonstrate in this fashion and what that will do to public parks, and the chairman raised that particular issue. I would say that allowing this activity to take place and this demonstration to occur does not mean you cannot enforce reasonable time, place, and manner regulations, including on the time and location of public demonstrations. But again, in McPherson Square, the regulations permit an assembly of this sort, a demonstration of this sort. I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Zick. Mr. Jarvis.
Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today to discuss the National Park Service's handling of the Occupy DC demonstrations at McPherson Square. This hearing takes place in the District of Columbia, the capital of our nation and the seat of our federal government. It is here, perhaps more than any other place in the United States, that Americans come to exercise their First Amendment rights to peacefully assemble, to petition their government for redress of grievances, and to exercise their right of freedom of speech. All 397 of America's national parks, but especially the national parks in Washington, D.C., are places where citizens' rights are guaranteed under our nation's Constitution. Among law enforcement agencies in the nation, the National Park Service and its urban law enforcement organization, the United States Park Police, have perhaps the greatest experience handling First Amendment activities. In 2011 alone, there were 626 permitted First Amendment activities on NPS lands here in Washington, D.C. Not all First Amendment activities require a permit. Therefore, these numbers are only a portion of those taking place in our capital city. A few examples of the historic large-scale First Amendment demonstrations here on NPS lands include the annual Right to Life March, the Million Man March, Promise Keepers, and the World Bank International Monetary Fund protests. Some of these events have changed our nation, such as when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Civil Rights March took place on the National Mall. Though many of these First Amendment demonstrations are short-term, some are longer-term vigils. In 1979, 6,000 family farmers drove their tractors to Washington, D.C. to protest American farm policy. They were on the mall for 7 weeks. A month after Dr. King's assassination, thousands of demonstrators set up a shanty town known as Resurrection City for a month-long vigil here in Washington. In 1985, the Vietnam Veterans Vigil Groups began to demonstrate on behalf of servicemen and servicewomen. Rolling Thunder continues that 24-hour vigil to this day. The success of the National Park Service and the U.S. Park Police in managing these demonstrations is directly attributed to our reasoned and measured and progressive response. The NPS and the U.S. Park Police handling of First Amendment activities begins with the lowest level of enforcement, and then increases if the situation warrants. This strategy ensures the health and safety of the demonstrators, as well as D.C. residents and visitors. Courts have recognized that this kind of reasoned and measured technique of law enforcement helps minimize the potential for disorder. The courts have also afforded the NPS a great deal of discretion to enforce rules and regulations in the manner that best fits the situation. In the case of the McPherson Square demonstration, NPS personnel concluded that the activities in the square were protected by the First Amendment and that there were less than 500 demonstrators. Therefore, in accordance to our regulations, no permit is required. NPS regulations do not allow for camping within McPherson Square. However, temporary structures, including tents, are permissible as a part of a demonstration, and a 24-hour round-the-clock vigil is also allowed. From the outset, the NPS has been working with the District of Columbia, including the Metropolitan Police Department, the Departments of Health, Fire, and EMS, to ensure that the demonstrators at McPherson are conducted in a safe and lawful manner. Just this week, we conducted a joint health inspection with the D.C. Department of Health. U.S. Park Police have at all times maintained a law enforcement presence and patrols at McPherson Square in order to protect health and safety of park visitors and the demonstrators, and have taken enforcement action when necessary. The NPS has employed a reasoned, measured, and incremental approach to address regulatory violations that minimize the threats to public safety while protecting First Amendment activities. This process has involved an evolution from outreach and education to formal notices of the rules that govern use of McPherson Square. I want to be clear that we take seriously residents and the district concerns and are constantly monitoring and evaluating conditions in the square. I understand this demonstration has impacted some District of Columbia businesses and visitors alike, and I appreciate their efforts to tolerate this activity. It is important to note that absent an emergency or threat to public or health and safety, demonstrators at McPherson Square must be allowed to continue their vigil in accordance with existing regulations and well-established judicial interpretations of their First Amendment rights. As long as the demonstration continues, however, the NPS will take an enforcement approach that seeks to protect public health and safety while respecting their First Amendment rights. This concludes my statement. I'm open to questions.
Chair would recognize himself for questions at this point. Mr. Jarvis, one reason that I like law enforcement, like Chief Lanier and the other men and women who are in uniform today and everywhere else across the country, is because there really aren't protesters that are Republican or Democrat in their judgment. There aren't laws that are Republican or Democrat. There aren't crime victims that are Republican or Democrat. It's just the law. So what I'm trying to glean is, what is the law? Because whatever you say with respect to McPherson Square is going to have to be applicable everywhere else in this country. So the notion that you think Washington may have special First Amendment privileges, it does not. There are no more First Amendment rights in this town than there are in any other city, town, hamlet in this country. So define camping for me, because you say it's prohibited. Tell me what it is.
Yes, sir. I agree with you that the First Amendment applies everywhere in the United States. It's just that in the District of Columbia, we have more experience with it, because we have more protests, we have more First Amendment activities in the district than any other place in the country. And the U.S. Park Police and the National Park Service that manage the National Mall handle hundreds of these kinds of events. And we take exactly the same approach every time, and that is a measured and reasoned response. What's unique about the McPherson Occupy group is that they are disorganized. There is no unit leader that we can go to and negotiate our expectations of their compliance.
Mr. Jarvis, I hate to cut you off. I've got 5 minutes. I need a definition of camping, because I need to go back to South Carolina and tell everyone who wants to spend the summer in one of our parks what camping is and what it is not. So define camping for me, juxtaposed with a 24-hour vigil, because you seem inclined to draw a distinction, and I can't draw a distinction. What is the definition of camping?
The distinction is, for a 24-hour vigil, is that they are awake at all times, providing information or signs or whatever associated with their First Amendment activities. Camping is defined as sleeping or preparing to sleep at the site.
Is there sleeping going on in McPherson Square?
Yes, sir, we do believe there is.
Is there preparing to sleep, or are they all insomniacs?
I believe that there are some preparing to sleep.
So you're not drawing a separate First Amendment rule for insomniacs versus narcoleptics?
What I am stating is that we do believe that there is some camping going on at McPherson Square associated with their vigil.
And how much investigation have you done into that?
We are, as I indicated, taking a measured and reasoned approach to this.
See, I don't know what that means. I'm just an old country prosecutor. Measured and reasoned approach doesn't mean anything to me. What means something to me is, can you define camping, because you strictly prohibit it. You just said it's going on. And that's fine. If you want to change the rules, that's fine. Just let me tell my constituents who want to visit D.C. this summer that they can come to any park they want to, and they can bring their tent as long as they say they're protesting. Can I tell them that?
They can bring their tent, absolutely.
And they can stay. They can sleep.
No, they cannot.
Is there sleeping going on at McPherson Square? You said there is. What's the difference?
What I said, and I will continue to say, is that the protesters, the demonstrators, exercising their First Amendment rights, have the rights to be in McPherson Square 24 hours a day. And we,
so
that's
you,
nothing
you,
new.
You view them as a unit, and as long as one of them is awake, then that gives constitutional cover for the rest to sleep. Is that the new analysis?
No, I do not say that. What I said is that they, as a group, have the right to be there on a 24-hour vigil. Individuals. The camping regulation is an individual violation, not a group violation.
How many people have been cited for camping?
At this point, none.
Well, you told me people were sleeping.
We are in the process of gaining compliance with the occupiers through a series of ramping up the enforcement at the site to gain compliance. That is the approach we have used with First Amendment activities in this town for decades, and it's been quite successful, and I think in this case it's been...
How long has gaining compliance been going on? When did the movement start in D.C.?
This particular movement began in October.
October, November, December, so 90 days, coming up on 100 days, is that right? How long do you think it will take you to gain compliance?
I hope we're going to gain complete compliance very soon.
No citations for sleeping.
We've issued a lot of other citations, but not particularly for camping.
Well, is that the linchpin of the definition of camping, sleeping?
Sleeping, yes, it is one of the definitions, sleeping or preparing to sleep.
So to prove your ideological neutrality, if the NRA or if the Chamber of Commerce or National Federation of Independent Businesses or anyone associated with the other side wants to come to McPherson Square this afternoon with tents, as long as one person remains vertical, they can stay.
I am ideological neutral on this. I could care less what their cause is. My job as a 35-year veteran of the National Park Service is to protect the individual's rights under the First Amendment. When each protest,
to protect their rights under the First Amendment, is it not also your job to enforce the law?
Absolutely, it's my job.
Is it against the law to camp?
The courts have afforded us a great deal of discretion in how we enforce the law in order to protect the First Amendment. And that's exactly what we're doing.
You agree the Supreme Court has said sleeping and camping can be prohibited?
Yes, they can. But at the same time, they gave us the discretion in how and when we implement that regulation.
All right, I'm going to be making sure that anyone who wants to camp throughout the United States, as long as they say they're in protest of something, can do whatever they want in federal parks.
You said that because the word occupy was in the name of this protest group, you were treating them a little differently. Was that right?
No, correct the record on that, let me just say that each First Amendment protest has its unique components. In this particular one, as has been stated by the professor, their principle behind their First Amendment activity is to, quote, unquote, occupy a piece of public land.
Which has given you a bit more discretion in how you deal with that.
Let's say a bit more of a challenge in how we deal with it.
Okay. And so if I had a group that was live in D.C., would you let me live there for a couple years? Or would you have more discretion with how you would deal with me if the name of my group was Live in D.C.? See what I'm saying?
I see what you're saying, but I don't think the name is, I'm not using it, let's say, with a capital O. I'm using it as in terms of a verb. They're
right.
Occupying the site. And any protest that comes to Washington, D.C. with First Amendment rights has to be evaluated in terms of how we deal with them to gain compliance. And that's this okay. one, as we said, it's unprecedented. We're working our way through this.
Thank you, Mr. Jeffers. Hey, Mr. Chairman, we, with your indulgence, we had staff last night pay a visit to Occupy D.C. With your permission, I'd love to show just a two-minute video. I think it seconds a lot of what Mr. Jarvis has said as far as them camping and sleeping.
But we're here in Occupy Wall Street, Washington, D.C. What square are we in?
This is McPherson.
McPherson Square. All right, sounds good. And then we've got a bunch of other occupiers. How long have you been here?
Been here since October 3rd.
October 3rd, so you've been here for 4 months. So there's got to be, what, like 50, 60 people staying here?
No, I'm most likely
probably about 100 now.
100, okay. Who was, like, the most? How many, when was, like, when it first started?
In the summertime, yeah. About close to 200.
200.
Like, talk. Can conjugate right in this jail area because a lot of people right around here all have to wake up early tomorrow morning sure. and go to the area.
Well, these two. Has the National Park Service been accommodating?
You know, for the most part, yeah, actually, the Park Service has defended our right to be here.
We did have lights on, but somebody came in here and ran wires to the pole because they had a TV, stereo, heater.
They were hooked. They had electric.
Yeah, and
put up to the pole. Wow.
The police seen the cables running across the ground and pulled them.
Yeah.
And put all the lights out, didn't okay. they? Got them turned back on yeah. again, and they did it again, so this time
okay. they're But they're generally, the Park Service, pretty nice. I mean, they're...
Yeah, they bring us trash bags, and we all get together, and...
Did they come and, like, lay out the law, like, kind of talk about
yeah,
what the hell
they... they had signs up at each entrance.
Okay.
So you can go by the rules.
Fair. Wow.
Look at that.
And you were saying the Park Service is pretty, they're helpful. Obviously, you guys got porta potties and stuff like that.
Yeah, we got porta potties over there. We got three of them.
Okay.
One big one and two little ones. We had five of them, but they came and took two. They come Wednesdays. No, they come Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays.
And what do they do for you?
They clean them out.
Oh, okay.
We also got a fountain where you can wash your hands and everything.
Okay.
You step on and just pump.
Okay.
Come
on. Park Service does that. And do they also, they were mentioned they do like health services and stuff for you guys too?
Yeah.
Okay.
They got a truck that is like a big motorhome they come.
Have you seen any rats when you're sleeping here at all? Or?
You might, I wouldn't be surprised if one might shoot out here. I've been calling them, I've been naming them. I've been naming one. I see one come out, I say, they go, John, look at him.
I'd like to invite my brothers and sisters from all over the nation who've been kicked out of their own occupations. Please feel free to come on down to D.C. Our doors are wide open. We'd love to have you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank the gentleman from Illinois. The chair would now recognize the other gentleman from Illinois, Mr. Davis.
Director Jarvis, let me ask, how do you distinguish between D.C. Occupy protesters and homeless people who might find their way into McPherson Square?
This has been a concern, Congressman, that we do believe some homeless people have moved in to join the occupiers and have taken advantage of the situation there, both in terms of the services. That's one reason we've been working with Metropolitan Health Department to provide social services at the site as well. And I think they have been subject to some of the arrests that we have made at the site for a variety of activities. But it is a concern.
Well, I'm delighted to know that there are some homeless people who have joined the Occupy protesters. But let me ask you, you have, in your testimony and in response to inquiry today, you've mentioned a number of times that there were other long-term vigils, you know, veterans, farmers. Did they go to hotels, to your knowledge, when they were there? How did they maintain themselves? I mean, did they come out during the day and then in the evening go down to the Grand Hyatt or someplace and get a room and sleep and then come back the next day and get on their tractors?
They maintain 24-hour vigils in each of those situations. I'm not knowledgeable enough about those actual protests to give any details as to how they manage all of that activity.
Then it would be fair to suggest that perhaps these protesters, Occupy D.C., are handled no differently than what other long-term vigil protesters have been treated.
I think that's correct. Yes, sir.
Well, let me thank you very much, because the more I listen to this discussion and the more I hear what has taken place and what has taken place, the more I'm convinced that your 35 years of law enforcement have served you well, that you've made some solid, sound, rational decisions, and you really represent the best of what law enforcement ought to be. I commend you, and I commend the Park Service for the way in which you've handled a very difficult situation, and that you really understand what it means to have freedom of speech, First Amendment protected. I yield back, Mr. Chairman.
Thank the gentleman from Illinois. The chair would now recognize the gentleman from California, the chairman of the full committee, Mr. Issa.
At times, protesters have come to the city, they've camped, and they've been in some way accommodated. You made that point in your opening statement. Have there been times in which protesters came, they camped, and they were not accommodated?
I really can't. I have no information on that. I don't know.
That was the subject of today's hearing. You came not knowing if you'd ever, if Park Police had ever arrested somebody who asserted that they were a protester, and you said, that's nice, but you can't camp here?
I'm sorry, I don't have that, but I'd be absolutely glad to find out and come back to the committee with that information.
We'd appreciate an answer for the record.
Yes.
This is a constitutional question to a great extent, and this is not the constitutional committee. This is the D.C. committee more than anything else. If we were to make it clear in the future through some statute, in addition to the Supreme Court decision, that protesters would not be accommodated unless that area was either permitted for by a request and a permit, and therefore, obviously, porta-potties, all the other facilities, which we do for various demonstrators, even if they're not staying the night, or, in fact, they stayed at a facility that was already allowed. In other words, if we made it clear in statute that it was not discretionary, and we did so uniformly by statute, would that pass the smell test of there are plenty of places to protest, but you can't sleep there, it's not a constitutional question? In other words, your testimony today in this problem, isn't ambiguity to a certain extent a problem?
Well, the regulation as it's written calls for a determination based on the totality about whether or not it's reasonably apparent that people are using it as a living accommodation. So that's lawyer speak for this is ambiguous, but also it's open to discretionary enforcement. With respect to whether you can write new rules in response to a protest, that could be problematic. They've tried that in some other jurisdictions in response to Occupy protests, I believe in Nashville. And the courts found that to be problematic. But if you wrote a statute or a law that
right, and we are talking about not for this particular group of protests, but for the future, for those that will come for issues not yet at the forefront.
If you're talking about that, and if you write and enforce the law in content-neutral terms, then to use your language, Mr. Chairman, it would pass the First Amendment smell test, certainly.
Okay, well, let me couch the final question for me for today, for each of you. Would that be helpful that in a post-protest period, I'm not talking about this week or next week when everyone would view it related to a particular group, would this be helpful? I'll start with the Park Service and come the other way. Would this be helpful for you to have predictability and certainty for the future? Mr. Jarvis.
Well, I think first and foremost we would have to evaluate whatever language that you would be proposing so that we completely understand its implications and how we would be tasked with enforcing it on the ground and whether or not it would be subject to challenge within the courts, which creates an additional burden.
Forget all that. It's not your job. From a standpoint of if you were told that one of the elements for discretion was not somebody saying, I'm here in a vigil, that would not exempt in any way, shape, or form their overnight camping. If we clarified that, and we'll assume the men and women in black robes will look at it and approve it, would that make your job better in long in the future? Your successors need to, in fact, bring uniformity and clarity, particularly as to the Second Amendment, or First Amendment.
I am not going to pass judgment.
The gentleman takes a pass on that, Mr. Zick.
I think given that the touchstone of First Amendment analysis is content neutrality, predictability would be beneficial. I'd be concerned about the impact on First Amendment rights. It makes no difference here that I disagree with the CCNV case. It is the law of the land. But in terms of writing something that is clear on its face and neutrally applied, yes, that would be a plus.
Good. And I will look forward to seeing your involvement if we get to that point. Doctor?
I believe, Mr. Chairman, that we have adequate laws, rules, and regulations in the District of Columbia that allow me to do my job in a respectful manner.
Chief, would this be good for you if you knew what to expect on federal lands adjacent or within the District of Columbia?
Well, for law enforcement purposes, predictability and very clearly written laws are always really important, especially when you're in deposition. So we always prefer, and predictability for planning purposes, especially because on our jurisdiction, things are always moving, or at least we try and keep them moving.
Mr. Crowder, you get the last one on behalf of yourself, the mayor, and the council.
Predictability and clarity are always extremely beneficial.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, thanks for the indulgence in my last round.
I thank the gentleman from California. The chair would now recognize the gentleman from Maryland, the ranking member of the full committee, Mr. Cummings.
Thank you very much. I've sat through this entire hearing, and I must tell you that I wish we had as much concern about the people who have lost their houses, the Americans who have suffered some $7 to $11 trillion worth of losses. It baffles me, it truly does, that we've now had over 118 hearings, 342 witnesses in this committee. And when we asked for somebody, one of the bankers, to come and tell us why they were robo-signing, violating the law, we can't get them. The chairman doesn't want them to come in to explain to us why it is that they have illegally put people out of their houses, offenses that they have already admitted to. And, you know, I guess people who are protesting and are part of Occupy, they look at a hearing like this and they say, this is why they're protesting. This is why. Because they see their government, particularly a committee that is supposed to be standing up for them, not addressing the issues that go to the center of their lives, period. And it's a damn shame. Because, you know, I listen to you, Mr. Jarvis. I get what you're doing. Some people would try to call it, selected prosecution. You're a practical man. You're a law enforcement officer. You've been trained. You don't want to incite a situation. You don't want it to get worse. So you try to contain it and try to work with people because you understand that these people are human beings. They're human beings. And they've come because they are concerned about what their government is not doing. So, I'm hoping that maybe a little tiny bit of the energy that we have put into this hearing will put into addressing the very things that the Occupy movement is all about and the things that they are concerned about. And maybe then we won't have to have these hearings. Then we won't have to worry about whether or not there'll be another Occupy. But I can tell you, as I'm just sitting here, I'm saying to myself, I understand it. I get it. And then another thing, I think about police officers. And I watch these guys here, these ladies and gentlemen of the Capitol Police. And I've seen many instances. They do it to perfection. I've seen situations where things could have gotten completely out of hand. But they find a way to try to resolve the issues and so that people can still have their rights fulfilled and do their protests or whatever. So, I'm just hoping that maybe, just maybe, some of the, you know, the message will come through to us that maybe we ought to have a hearing and bring in Mazzello or bring in some of the guys and ladies who may have been the cause of the problems that our people are going through and may be the cause of some of those people who are sitting in those very camps who've been thrown out of their houses. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
I thank the gentleman from Maryland. The chair would now recognize the gentle lady from the District of Columbia, Ms. Holmes Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief Lanier, would you say that the Occupy movement was predictable?
Yeah, we weren't the first Occupy camp, so yes, we knew the Occupy
the was coming. Not here in the District of Columbia.
Correct.
When the first Occupy protest broke out in New York, could that have been predicted?
No.
I ask that question only because, above all, law enforcement needs to have ample discretion. And the best way to get slapped down is to get an ironclad rule written into law that then goes up to the courts and up to the Supreme Court. I speak to you as a First Amendment lawyer who's been there and done that. It would hurt you as much as it would hurt the occupiers, and I don't think we want more tests of that kind. We want more compliance and certainly no escalation of violence. Mr. Jarvis, it would appear that the responses of the occupiers have affected the kind of enforcement that the Park Service has deemed to be necessary. Now, here's a question I would have asked the occupiers if there had been a witness, but you're the next best thing, so I'm going to have to ask you. What steps have the occupiers taken to police themselves and to respond to the concerns that you have raised, or that the police or others have raised?
Over the period of months I've been working with them, they have executed a number of things voluntarily in terms of site cleanup, the areas in which they're distributed in McPherson. One comment was made earlier that the National Park Service is providing the porta potties. That's not true. The occupiers are providing both the services and the cleaning of those porta potties. So they have brought a great deal of organization to the site and have been working. I think the relationship that we have on the ground is significantly different than when they first arrived. I walked through the camp myself last week with U.S. Park Police. We were greeted friendly and were able to talk directly to many of the demonstrators, and they thanked us for the work that we were doing there.
Well, I certainly want to go on record as to thank the Occupy movement for being responsive to the police and to remind them that, as they've heard from the rostrum and perhaps even from the table, there are some who would not be as friendly to First Amendment rights, and the more we can call their bluff, it seems to me, by cooperation and with the nonviolence exemplified by, of course, the icon of successful nonviolence that brought change, Dr. Martin Luther King, the better off we would be. I have to ask Mr. Zick about this notion of the nation's capital as a special place. During the Arab Spring, you couldn't get to the floor, but people were, of course, competing to egg on all of the demonstrators of the Arab Spring. Egg on, even if it brought a revolution. Egg on, even if it brought down a government that had been friendly to the United States of America. To the floor we all came on both sides of the aisle. And, of course, there was a revolution. And many of them said that they had looked to demonstrations in this country and were very grateful for the response we have had in this country. Well, the place they look to is not Oakland or Portland, or if my good friend, and he is a good friend, will forgive me, not even Charleston. The place they look to, I dare say, is the nation's capital. I would like, therefore, while I agree with the chairman about how the Supreme Court will look at first at the First Amendment as what it is, if I may say so, to confer a set of preferred rights. That's how important First Amendment rights have been in our country. And if you look at the 5-4 split on the court, isn't it interesting that there are not many splits when it comes to the First Amendment? I'd like, to ask your expert opinion, given the place where we are and its visibility to the world, what the effect of suppression of the Occupy movement in the nation's capital would have been had the Park Police acted in ways other than how they have chosen to act.
Well, I think suppression anywhere would be problematic, but I take your point. This is a special place, not in the sense that it confers special rights. I think that's an important point to keep in mind, but the context is critical. The places we're talking about, if you talk about the National Mall, Lafayette Square Park, this was a point made by Justice Marshall and by Justice Brennan in the CCNV case. Those are unique places, not only because your right to petition the federal government applies here in the district and not elsewhere. That's a special right. But even with respect to speech and assembly rights, those are iconic, sacred, inscribed places in our history. And I think that would send a very bad signal to the public at large and maybe to the world at large with respect to our respect for First Amendment rights that we tell the world are exceptional.
Thank you very much.
Thank the gentlelady from the District of Columbia. Mr. Ochter, very briefly, are you familiar with any civil liability exposure the district may have?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware at this time.
Have you been immunized by the federal government for any civil lawsuits that may take place as a result of anything that may happen?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware. I've been immunized by D.C. government as a government employee.
I wasn't referring to your own personal immunity. I hope you don't need any. I don't need any either. But my concern, I guess, Professor Zick, you correct me if I'm wrong. It's been a long time. I think evidence of the violation of a rule or regulation can be evidence per se or evidence of negligence in a civil suit, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, I guess I'll finish where I started. I don't understand the sense or the use of having a rule or regulation if it's not going to be enforced. It just strikes me that the process by which we go through in this country is if you don't like a law or a rule, you change it. And if you don't feel like you can change it, we have a long, rich history of civil disobedience in this country. The most famous epistle on civil disobedience was written where, Professor Zick?
I'm sorry?
See if you would agree with me. The most famous letter with respect to civil disobedience was written where?
The Birmingham jail.
Jail, right? Not Birmingham, but the jail. So my point is this. If you don't like the law, change it. But to ask Mr. Jarvis, Chief Lanier, the Capitol Hill Police, who all have very difficult jobs, to also have to decide which laws to enforce and which ones not to. Mr. Cummings and others have spoken very eloquently about the frustration with a multi-tiered society with respect to fairness. We have exactly the same issues if we have a multi-tiered society with respect to which laws we're going to enforce and which ones we're not. So my advice is either enforce the rule or regulation as written or change it. But selecting it in some states and not others will undermine respect for the rule of the law. With that, on behalf of all of us, we want to thank all of the witnesses for your comedy towards one another, for your respect and expertise with respect to your interactions with us on the panel. And with that, we are adjourned.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, where you have been listening to the House Oversight Committee's hearing on whether to permit or outlaw the D.C. Occupy movement in the nation's capital. We welcome your comments and queries with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. With engineering by Michael G. Haskins and Reggie Johnson of Pacifica Station WBAI, I'm Robert Knight in New York for 5 o'clock Shadow.